Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking to do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Boy, my voice is considerably cleared up since from last week's change of season cold. We've got two interviews lined up for tonight. First, in a little bit, we'll hear from Andrew Ross, who is a professor at NYU and author of the book Nice Work, If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Times, just out from NYU Press. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with another author of a book just out. This is the second edition of Michael Yates' book, Why Unions Matter. We'll talk to Michael about why labor should be organized and maybe why it isn't in the United States and what the consequences of that are for the workers and for politics in general. Before all that, let's a review of some of the headlines before hitting some big picture stuff for some brief comments. More tentative signs of some slight gloom lifting in the job market. First-time claims for unemployment insurance, filed by people who've just lost their jobs, fell by 14,000 last week, and the four-week average is now about 20,000 below its high set about a month ago. As I've noted here before, the yearly percentage change in these weekly claims figures has proven a pretty reliable early warning sign that a recession is drawing to a close, and that measure peaked in February. So this is suggesting that the worst may be over. But, and this is a very big fat but, that doesn't mean that the good is about to begin. The number of people continuing to draw unemployment insurance benefits, continuing claims in the jargon, rose last week and has been drifting steadily higher. In fact, the behavior of the continuing claims series suggests that when the Bureau of Labor Statistics releases its April employment data next Friday, the unemployment rate is likely to rise towards the neighborhood of 9% from March's 8.5%. Putting all this together, let's say that while the pace of job loss is probably slowing, hiring remains in the doldrums and is likely to stay there for many months to come. It could be a year before you start to see plus signs in the monthly employment figures. GDP for the first quarter in the U.S. fell at a 6.1% annual rate, adjusting for inflation, only slightly less than the 6.3% fall at the end of 2008. The first quarter decline was the sixth worst in the nearly 250 quarters since the figures began in 1947, and the two quarters together, that is the last of 08 and the first of 09, are the second worst back-to-back performance over that same 60-year period. The only worst two-quarter period was 1958, in the midst of a short, sharp recession. This one is sharp, but it isn't short. So in other words, this is all quite bad. Under the headline number, there were some really awful figures. Real investment fell by over 50% at an annualized rate. Business investment in machinery and equipment, the motor of economic growth over the long term in capitalist economies, fell at a 34% annual rate. Investment in new housing was off 38%. Again, these are all annualized numbers. Exports were off 30%. Imports 34%, and I should say by annualized, I mean if the quarterly pace was continued for a whole year. For some reason, consumers bought a lot of durable goods in the first quarter, things like cars and appliances. That gain kept the headline GDP figure from being even worse than it was. But consumption had been falling very dramatically, so this looks a bit like what Wall Street calls a dead cat bounce, meaning that if you drop a dead cat from a high enough level, it will bounce as if alive, but the cat will still be dead. Speaking of car sales, which were up astonishingly around 20% in the first quarter after falling almost twice that much in the previous 3 months, news that Chrysler will file for bankruptcy, while hardly surprising, is still arresting. Once an iconic industrial corporation, it became the beneficiary of the first modern bailout in 1979. That one involved $1.5 billion in loan guarantees on which the Treasury actually made money. The company recovered, and its CEO at the time, Lee Iacocca, became a celebrity. This crisis looks a lot deeper and more structural. For a while, it looked like the Obama administration had gotten Chrysler's creditors to agree to a restructuring of the firm that would have kept it out of bankruptcy court. Fiat would have gained operational control of the company, and the United Auto Workers would have owned over half of the stock. And aside, it's amazing to see Fiat in the role of the savior of an American auto company and the source of advanced engine and manufacturing technology. Americans used to laugh at Italian industry. Who's the laugh on now, Paisani? In any case, the speculation is that Chrysler will emerge from the bankruptcy process looking pretty much like the deal that the administration had arranged for in the first place. We shall see. Sometimes the process is unpredictable. At the same time, GM is going through a similar restructuring that could well end up in bankruptcy court as well. If that happens, the firm's bondholders would see their paper turn into stock, making them, in partnership with the UAW and the government, the company's new owners. Let's bracket all the details of this for now and focus on one thing. The United Auto Workers is likely to become a large and perhaps controlling stockholder in two major industrial enterprises. What will it do with them? Sad to say, probably nothing. It's likely that the courts and the government will assure the union's stockholdings are largely on paper, with no rights of ownership to be exercised. Will the UAW complain about this muzzling? Probably not, which is a sign of just how brain-dead the American labor movement has become. Here would be a wonderful opportunity to restructure a crucial industry. The UAW, had it had anything like a vision or a public spirit, could have spearheaded the development of a new earth-friendly kinds of cars and new worker-friendly ways of making them. It has given no sign of ever having thought about anything like this. Here it is, with two enormous potential gifts dropped into its collective lap, and it doesn't even know what to do. Tragic. And I see a lot of labor radicals can do little but lament how the workers are giving up wages and benefits and the retirees are being screwed, and all of them are suffering from management's mistakes. All this is very true, but the companies are broke. There is just no money to pay wages or benefits. The bourgeoisie isn't making this up as a part of a big con game. The UAW sat quietly by during the deceptively fat years of the 1990s, when low oil prices encouraged the sale of high-profit SUVs, and the domestic car industry ignored its underlying rot. For more than 60 years, the UAW paid no attention to the strategic direction of the industry, which has been in varying stages of crisis for almost half that time. And now it's badly, perhaps terminally screwed. What will it take to wake the American working class up? Okay, let's take a little musical break, and I will be back.
And the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning striding behind you, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust.
And that, some of Rudimentary Peni from my album that came out last year, A Handful of Dust. And I played that shortly after the album came out, but I neglected to include the introduction from the man himself. That was T.S. Eliot reading The Passage of the Wasteland that inspired Rudimentary Peni's Handful of Dust. Okay, we're now joined in the studio by Andrew Ross, who is chair of the NYU Department of Social and Cultural Analysis and author of many books, most recently, Nice Work If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Times, just out from NYU Press. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. Welcome.
So let's start with something in the news. I was reading in the New York Post on Thursday that your employer, NYU, is informing a lot of students who are admitted without having the means to pay the $50,000 freight that it costs to get through NYU, telling them that maybe they're too poor to go there and they should go elsewhere, which made me think of the larger question, which is something you write about often, which is something you write about in this book, the restructuring of the university to be rather like a business. And NYU in the fat years was opening up campuses on Dubai and all over the place and just generally behaving like an expansive enterprise. What's it like when the corporate university hits recession?
It's a good question. The old habits die hard, so the wheels are still spinning. But clearly there's not so much money around. And it's impacting us in all sorts of ways. There's still the plans to expand overseas, thinking about more offshore sites, and certainly in Abu Dhabi. They're building a whole new
university. It's Abu Dhabi, not Dubai, Dhabi. Right, sorry.
Big difference.
Wrong emirate, I apologize.
Abu Dhabi has astronomical amounts of money. Dubai is in a big hole right now. I don't think Abu Dhabi's money is going to run out anytime soon. But most recently, NYU is embarking on its latest effort to union bust graduate student employees. This is a long-standing effort, and it's moved into its most recent phase in the last month or so.
What is driving this sort of thing? I mean, in a capitalist enterprise, it's the accumulation of profit. It's easy to understand. At the university, what is driving this corporatization?
Well, it's very difficult for me to convince my colleagues that in many ways they're on the front line of knowledge capitalism. But in many respects, they are. The research universities, especially, and knowledge corporations there's more and more crossover between the two of them. They're both, mutating into species, hybrid species. They're no longer what they used to be, either of them, and there's a lot of crossover between them, sort of Schumpeterian entrepreneurs who shuttle back and forth between the corporate campus and the university campus, and they're very much spearheading the new developments in knowledge capitalism.
Now, I can understand how... the biology department might be able to take advantage of this. A medical school might be able to take advantage of this. What does this mean for the Department of Cultural Studies or the English department or the French department?
Well, it's a good question. The American middle liberal arts model is becoming more and more popular overseas. So we're beginning to see, overseas states with large foreign currency reserves getting into the business of buying some top American brands or top Anglophone brands and reproducing the liberal arts model. It's a model that traditionally has been used to reproduce an elite. And, all societies need elites that are trained in conduct and the manners that orient themselves towards the new forms of capitalism. And I think that's in large part how the export of those particular disciplines is going to play its role.
The part of the education of that elite used to be about behaving as like a cultured person. In this new model, which is very money-driven, is this what the new model of the elite is? You don't have to be a cultured person. You just have to be able to rake it in?
Well, not necessarily, no. You have to be... And here's the difference between the old colonial universities abroad and the new kind of universities abroad. They're all about adapting trainees to the mores of knowledge society and of knowledge capitalism. It's not necessarily about how you hold your wine glass, but it's about how you respect capitalist rationality in the various elite watering holes of the world. And there's a particular kind of training, I think, that probably goes along with that. And it's best inducted in the kind of free trade zones in overseas sites where we see a lot of Anglophone universities setting up shop with their foreign branches.
And how does that new ethic influence the curriculum of someone in Department of Cultural Analysis?
It hasn't affected us as yet. We haven't been asked to contribute, but I'm sure our day will come.
So they take it out of your hide at budget time, or are you able to get by?
For the time being, we're able to get by.
And now, also, what about the labor conditions in this modern university? What can you say about the model of how work is done and the stratification of the labor market within the university?
Well, in this country, I don't think it's any secret that the higher education sector, the academic profession among all the professions, has seen the most rapid and most pervasive rate of casualization of any profession in the last 15 years or so. At NYU, 72% of the teaching is off the tenure track at this point. So the march of contingency from low-wage sectors where temping began The march of contingency into high-wage sectors, and especially into the knowledge industries and the creative, what are often referred to as the creative industries, has been very rapid and nowhere more rapid than in higher education. And this manifests itself in all sorts of ways that the public is becoming more and more aware of. There's all sorts of efforts to try to stem that, but it's basically a kind of donut-style economy, that stratification where you have a handful of experts who are, you know, tenured and have a lot of expertise and credentials, and they provide handcrafted attention to elite students, and then they're surrounded by this vast army of adjuncts and part-timers and graduate student employees who do the grunt work. And that's a model that is certainly apparent in other industries, but in many ways it's most pronounced and most pervasive in the academic industry.
But we also have seen pervasive consumer model of higher education, the student as consumer that has to be satisfied. How do these consumers feel about being taught, almost three-quarters of them being taught by people who are not stars but who are exploited low-wage workers when they're paying $50,000 plus to go to NYU?
Somewhat ambivalent. I mean, you know, the more radical among them kick up some dust, and there's always a minority of radical students in every campus from year to year who will do the right thing and act up and so on and so forth. But I'd say the majority of undergraduate students, they know what they're paying, and they want what they're paying for. They know what their parents are paying, and they want what they're paying for, and they have their eyes on the prize of that credential and that degree. And it's so high priced that it's not something they take in any way less than seriously.
I guess once you're paying the bill, you're not going to ask yourself too many questions, right? Now, I think a lot of people may be listening and be skeptical about feeling a great deal of sympathy with college professors. You know, there's a kind of populism that views college professors as pampered members of an elite and not something that we should think about in any kinds of sense of labor solidarity. Is that a mistake or for people to think that way?
Certainly, I don't think it's a mistake if you're thinking about an elite, you know, the elite cadre at research universities who are paid lavish salaries and have a relatively privileged life and certainly enjoy academic freedom. I mean, a degree of freedom of speech that's unavailable anywhere else in society. My comrade Stanley Aronowitz has described this as the last good job in America. But the vast majority of teachers in higher education have conditions and salaries and a radical uncertainty about their future that is in a completely different universe from that small and shrinking elite for the most part. But it's generally that elite that is in the public imagination, as with many aspects of the culture wars, because a lot of the culture wars were trained on the proclivities of that elite. And we don't get so much public attention to the huge numbers of adjunct teachers who actually qualify for food stamps in this country because their wages, their yearly wages, are below the threshold, and they qualify for food stamps.
I think the same is true of interns at certain elite publishing outfits in New York City. So it's not the only kind of labor market where that is experienced. Now, would you say this kind of model is representative of culture work broadly throughout New York City, the American economy?
I think it is. I mean, a lot of my book is about how in the last two decades our lives and livelihoods have become so precarious. And you know, I trace out the reasons for that and explain how and why the employment base has crumbled so rapidly as a result in the last year or so. This condition of precarity, this precarious condition, is as prevalent in high wage sectors of the so-called creative class as low wage sectors of the service class, In New York City, of course, we have an over-concentration, some would say, of the so-called creative class. And it would be surprising for some folks listening to know that the Freelancers Union, which is the union of choice increasingly for a lot of those folks, is now the third biggest union in New York City. They have about 70,000 members, and they're growing very, very fast. They have about...
It's a way to get discount health insurance, which is why I'm a member.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
But the numbers are quite striking. And nationwide, you know, there's about 110,000 members, I think. It's typical of the kind of union arrangement that has sprung up to address these precarious circumstances, and is one of the offshoots of I would say, one of the more progressive parts of the labor movement that is thinking about organizing non-standard workers in non-standard employment conditions.
I'm speaking with Andrew Ross, who is a professor at NYU and author of Nice Work, If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Times. And this is a collection of essays on a number of topics, so it's a little hard for me as an interviewer to organize a coherent discussion of it. But let me shift gears to another piece in there, which is very interesting, where you write about attempts to link an anti-sweatshop movement with a consumer movement to bridge the gap between production and consumption, in other words. There's certainly there's this kind of, you know, this Adbusters movement, which is almost moralistic in its condemnation of advertising. There are anti-sweatshop movements which have a lot more in common with traditional labor movements or organizing on behalf of poor workers, although using the buying power of consumers in solidarity with the labor movement. Is it possible for these different worlds to talk to each other?
I hope so. I mean, that's the reason that I wrote the chapter. I was sort of reviewing each of these movements, the anti-consumer movement, the anti-sweatshop movement, and considering what each of them have been negligent about, respectively, and what each of them could learn from one another. The anti-sweatshop movement could be much more attentive to conditions of sustainability instead of simply fixing a goal of retaining or building decent jobs with a halfway decent contract, thinking about the sustainability of these jobs as not just as livelihoods, but also the sustainability of the environment that they might support. And ultimately, you know, approaching the jobs with an environmental audit in hand and asking, well, you know, do we really need these products?
You quote a very funny Onion story about a Chinese worker who says, "I can't believe all the crap," yeah, euphemism, "that Americans buy." It's unimaginable on several levels, but think about that for us. I mean, yeah. Why is that so unimaginable that a Chinese worker might actually say that?
The Chinese worker might think that.
But why would an American journalist not really actually see a Chinese worker that way?
Well, because that worker's livelihood is probably entirely based on access to that particular job opportunity. These are very tenuous and fragile job opportunity circumstances in these workplaces, as you know. But I think the movement as such and the anti-sweatshop movement has reached several turning points in its history, but it's currently another one. Given the recession, I think this is something that really has to be borne in mind as we hear these calls repeatedly for efforts to build a green collar economy, that folks really have to approach production with an environmental audit in mind. I mean, we're used to hearing about consumer items and putting carbon labels in consumer items. Tesco's, the supermarket chain in the UK, is doing that now, putting a carbon label on every consumer product. I think we need to start thinking about jobs in that respect, too. On the other side, the anti-consumer movement tends to be very skeptical of greenwashing. It tends to be very skeptical of corporate social responsibility, but it also is fairly inattentive to the conditions under which the mass of people work for their livelihoods. It's a kind of minority avant-garde mentality that the anti-consumer movement has. And I think it could be a little more attentive to traditional labor issues. So I guess what I'm arguing is that both of these movements have a lot to learn from one another, and we really need that kind of coalition, which hasn't been talked about until recently.
You know, if you're remembering the anti-sweatshop movement and a lot of the stuff around the WTO in the late 90s, organized during boom times when it was easy to say that we're just consuming too much. It was a period of excess. Now here we are in a period of recession when I think a lot of people would just like to go back to the old days. Is there anything in this present moment that offers possibility of thinking our way out of this box?
Well, it's it is a point of opportunity for the labor movement, of course. The fact is that green collar jobs are pretty crappy jobs. They pay very little right now. Solar energy jobs, wind energy jobs, average about $8 an hour. They're completely non-unionized. And these are the companies and industries that will be taking big government subsidies. So there really has to be a moratorium on that kind of employment in the actually existing green economy, which is not a great place to work right now. So the labor movement has to really put some heft in there, and lay out some conditions for any government stimulus money that's going to go into green collar industry to ensure that there are decent jobs. I mean, $8 an hour versus average manufacturing wage is about $18 an hour in this country. So that's a big gap.
And finally, we live in a city which, as you pointed out earlier, the cultural industries play a very large role. Was it 12 or 15% of the workforce that is employed in such things? Is that really a strong foundation to build an urban economy on? Or do we need to diversify away from that some?
Well, I think people cite that figure because they cite it as evidence that the New York City economy is slightly more diverse than the way we think of it, which is fire industry, you know, finance, insurance, and real estate, which is about 25% of the payroll in this city still, or at least it was until recently. But the reason why there's been so much interest on the part of urban managers in that so-called creative class is because the policy making that attracts those kinds of jobs is very cheap to do. It's not, you know, compare it to the billions of dollars that cities spend in sports stadia or fly-by-night corporations in terms of lavish tax exemptions and so on and so forth. What they can do for the creative class is relatively cheap. You know, some biking trails, they love to bike. A few coffee houses, they love coffee. Some loft-like environments, and so on and so forth. I'm patronizing this attitude, but it is the attitude that urban managers have had, not necessarily in New York City, because New York City has no trouble attracting creative workers, but in a lot of second-tier cities around the country. But the bottom line is that they know these are gentrifying agents. They know that the creative class, wherever they go, wherever they settle, have a tendency to boost property value, and that's one of the main reasons why there's been so much interest in courting that talent pool over the last several years or so. Some of those policies are being rethought right now as a result of the bust in the real estate markets, but I expect to see that tendency revive itself in some different format very soon.
Well, that really, all that stuff got started in the last major bust back in the late 70s, mm-hmm. So I guess it's been a new lease on life for the culture industries as the rescue of a failing economy. All right, I've been speaking with Andrew Ross, who is a professor at NYU and author of the book Nice Work, If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Times, and a collection of essays that shows Andrew's usual intelligence and style and breadth of interest. And good luck with the book. Thanks. Thanks for coming by, Andrew.
Thank you, Doc.
All right, let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about labor again.
We are so wet, so gospel choir. Zumba, zumba, zumba. Zumba, zumba, zumba. And you are listening.
And this is WBAI, not only on your FM dial at 99.5 in New York, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And don't forget to visit the website and hit the donate button if you are so inclined and feeling flush enough to do so, because God knows we need the cash. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about unions with Michael Yates. And that's some of Schubert's impromptu D936, number one, performed by Alfred Brendel. We are now joined by Michael Yates, who is the author of the book Why Unions Matter, just appearing in its second edition from Monthly Review Press. Michael, a retired professor of economics who has taken up traveling around the United States and writing very intelligent and perceptive pieces about that on his his blog, Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate, which is also the title of an earlier book he did with Monthly Review Press. And he is the associate editor of Monthly Review and editorial director of MRS Press. Welcome to Behind the News, Michael.
Oh, thanks, Doug. Good to be here.
And you are now in Boulder, right?
Yes.
You've been traveling all over the place?
We settle in one place and then get tired of it and settled in a new place. And then in between, we just move around.
That sounds like not a bad way to retire.
Well, it's been pretty good so far.
And you've gotten to see a lot of this great country of ours, huh?
Well, yeah, it's a great country physically.
There are a few social problems out there, though. Huh?
Yes, indeed.
Well, let's talk your new book. The second edition of Why Unions Matter, and Let me put on my right-wing Yahoo hat for a moment and ask you this sort of question. I was just reading a piece in the Wall Street Journal by Paul Ingracia, who was the paper's Detroit bureau chief for many years, covering the automobile industry, moved on to an executive position at Dow Jones, and is now writing a book on the auto industry, which should be out shortly. But he was ranting about how the UAW, having destroyed the domestic auto industry, is now going to essentially take it over because it's going to get a lot of stock in the companies, GM and Chrysler in particular, as they fail. I think a lot of people would say that the unions destroyed the auto industry, and this is what we are now seeing the result of that. How would you respond to somebody who said something like that?
Well, I would just say that I don't know how the workers could ruin an industry that they don't own. I mean, all the basic decisions, I would say probably where the union went wrong was conceding so many decisions to the employers in terms of how the plants are run, what kind of technology is used, how hard the workers work, you know, what the daily work routine is like, the price of the product, the kinds of products, the environmental aspects of production. The union conceded all of those to the employer, and it seems to me that where the companies went wrong was that they made an awful lot of bad decisions in terms of the kinds of cars that they made. And the union had actually GM on record in a previous contract in favor of national health insurance, and the company had agreed to push and lobby for that, but it never did, and the union never held its feet to the fire about that either. So I would say that you have a so-called free enterprise system, then the owners are the responsible party. Anything that they agreed to in the bargaining, they agreed to. You know, anything that's in the contract, the employers agreed to that. Saw it in their interest to agree to that, and so how you could blame the workers for what's gone wrong with the auto industry is beyond me. And not only that, but if you think about if you look at it from just a point of view of aggregate demand, the workers making pretty good money having decent benefits and so on and so forth is good for the economy as a whole because they buy things. They don't use the emergency rooms for their primary health care, et cetera, because they have decent health care. They have the kind of things that all workers should strive for, and that the United Auto Workers should have striven for all workers too, but didn't. So, I mean, I would blame the union for a lot of things, believe me. But running the companies into the ground just wouldn't be one of them.
Well, why has the UAW been so passive in the face of the what was now a more than 30-year crisis in the auto industry? They had that period in the 90s where fuel prices were low. They were making a lot of money in SUVs, so it looked like things were okay for a while. But, you know, this is an industry that's faced very, very serious challenges since the early 1970s and has failed to respond to them very effectively. Why has the UAW been so passive in the face of that?
Well, I think probably you got to go back to the beginning almost. I mean, the union, what strikes me is that this is a union that was a model of sort of militant rank-and-file worker actions in terms of how the union was formed and the sit-down strikes and willingness to defy police and governors and whatever and the companies to build a reasonably good union. But I always think of it this way. You know, this economic system is called a hegemonic system for a reason, and that is because it infiltrates all aspects of life, including workers' lives. And so unions are surrounded, and union leaders are surrounded by a society that rewards certain kinds of behavior. And so it's not surprising that there's strong pulls on union leaders to do that, to make themselves into, like the UAW is always called a one-party state, you know, where dissent is not much tolerated and where there aren't rank-and-file caucuses that do much inside the union like there had been in some other unions. And so what Walter Reuther did when he took power in the union after he defeated the left, which put him, you know, in good stead with the companies, with the government, which had pretty much made being a red a crime, and signed the Treaty of Detroit with GM, I believe, around 1948, a long-term contract, which ceded to the companies all of the basic decisions in terms of the daily work routine and the kinds of products and et cetera, et cetera. And by tying the well-being of the workers to the success of those companies, you can see, and then succumbing to the kinds of culture of sort of hierarchical management inside the union, you can see how it would be a short step to sort of move towards cooperating with the union, being as afraid of your members as you are of the companies. Labor management cooperation, you can see how that would gradually lead into concession bargaining when the companies demanded it. Because the union failed to develop its progressive trajectory, Reuther broke that in effect, you can see how sort of one step followed after the other, and you take on a defensive posture, and that becomes your way of life. That becomes sort of your strategy as opposed to maybe a temporary tactic. And then you don't know what to do. You can't lead if you didn't lead. You know, if you had this long history of, well, when things were going well, of course, they could win benefits for those auto workers. But in terms of a long-term plan where you see that that probably is never going to continue over the long haul, because that's just not the way an economic system like this works. When GM was making about a 25% rate of return on its capital, well, naturally that attracted other competitors to industry. And so you can't have that kind of thing. You have to have a longer-term, more socially conscious trajectory. But once you abandon that, it's like a slippery slope that leads you down to tying your well-being to the well-being of the company, and sort of everything follows out from that. It's sort of the way I would look at it. I mean, that's a sort of a complicated kind of argument and hard to deal with in a couple of minutes, but that's sort of the way I would look at it. I mean, the union has, just like the AFL-CIO, I mean, the company started attacking the workers in the 1970s, and the AFL-CIO leadership doesn't change until, 1995? It was a long time that went by, and you have all those leaders trained in that kind of bureaucratic, Samuel Gompers kind of unionism. How do you break out of that? It's advantageous to the leaders too. I mean, they make a lot of money. It's advantageous for them to have a sort of a dictatorial kind of political structure inside the unions, because then they can't be defeated, and they never have to go back to the assembly line to work. It's advantageous to them. This society rewards that kind of thing. It takes a lot of courage and a really strong set of principles. And the union movement is bereft of those. That's sort of the way I would look at it. I know that's maybe not as specific as you wanted.
No, but that's all very
that's
good.
That's sort of the way I would look at it. It's like a whole culture that fits right into the overall culture. And the best you can do is be defensive then. You're never on the offensive. You never have a plan. You never have a set of principles. Like the right wing did. You have principles. You stick with them through hell and high water. You make tactical concessions when you have to, but you don't concede on principles. So if you have to go down fighting, then you go down fighting.
I'm speaking with Michael Yates, who is the author of Why Unions Matter, just out in its second edition from Monthly Review Press. And let's enough of the critical stuff for a little while. Let's talk about one of the reasons that this history that we've been talking about is so tragic is that unions can mean an awful lot for working people. So let's talk about just what unions can mean for working people.
Well, as I show in my book, of course, they mean a lot better wages and terms and conditions of employment. I mean, if you look at the comparison between union and non-union in terms of wages, they're considerable. But not only that, but unions benefit the worst off workers the most. They benefit those with the least education, for example. They benefit blue-collar workers more than white-collar workers. They benefit black workers and Hispanic workers more than white workers. So they help to bring about greater equality in the wage structure. And we know now that the tremendous growth in inequality that's accompanied the last 30, 40 years of economic policy in the United States is bad in and of itself in all kinds of ways. It leads to more prison admissions, leads to lower leads to lower birth weight of children and a whole pile of bad things. So greater equality is a good thing. It's easier to have solidarity when there's a little bit greater equality. So that's one of the things that unions do. They bring better fringe benefits. They give workers greater voice inside of the workplaces. You always hear workers say that one of the things they wanted was respect. I mean, we live in a society where workers are treated as costs of production, but they don't think of themselves like that. So a union helps to change that dynamic. Plus, union workers are more aware of their rights under the law. They're more aware of how the unemployment compensation system works, the workers' compensation system works, the health care systems work. They're more aware of things. Unions educate their members to a certain degree, although it's certainly not enough, in my opinion, to be aware of things, to understand what's going on in the world, to make better political choices. And those are all good things. A union movement can influence the political system and lead to more progressive laws being passed, laws that benefit all workers. And the labor movement in the United States has done some of that too, and that's all to the good. So unions can mean an awful lot of good things. And plus, a union provides a space in which workers can settle differences in a sort of a peaceful. It doesn't always work like that, but I remember teaching a class one time to these auto workers, and a white male started yapping about the welfare system, and a black woman says, "Wait a minute, brother." And they start to argue about it, you know what I mean? But it's in the context of brothers and sisters inside the union. I know that sounds a little corny maybe, but that's oftentimes the case. And that means a lot in a society that's so individualistic as this one, where people are so alienated and so isolated. A union is a collective entity, and that means a lot. We need more of those. So those are the positive things. And unions provide workers with good lessons in how to do things for themselves and how to run for office and how to participate in a democratic institution or to make it more democratic. It gives workers some say about things.
Yeah, actually, that individualistic society that you're talking about, my wife, Liza Featherstone, has wrote a book about Walmart workers, women workers in Walmart particularly. And she quoted one of them saying, "I don't need a union. I can take care of myself. I got a big mouth." Now, this is a woman who had not received a promotion or a pay increase in years and years and years, but she nonetheless thought she could take care of things on her own. And this is a pervasive attitude in the American working class.
That's a really good point. I mean, I used to say that I was a college teacher, so that's, a lot more status and a lot better pay than a Walmart worker. And I used to go wild with teachers that would say that kind of thing. You know, one guy saying, "I want to go to the dean and I'll haggle, I'll deal with him face to face." And I says, "But you don't even know what your coworkers make in pay. So when you go into the dean's office, you go as an individual. The dean represents the entire university, which has a nearly billion-dollar budget and uses a law firm that used to serve Andrew Carnegie. I mean, you don't have a chance." Now imagine you know, he's saying that as a college professor. Imagine, it's even sadder, horrible, tragic that a Walmart worker would say that she has a big mouth and she can get what she wants. I mean, that's... Now, of course, you know, workers learn by hard experience, then she'll get fired someday when she opens her mouth, and then she might be singing a different tune, like a lot of teachers that I knew that didn't get tenure started saying that sort of thing, wish they had a union. But you're right. I mean, that kind of attitude is pervasive in this society. I went to a car dealer the other day. I have a Dodge, and I said, you know, I really feel bad about what's happening in the auto industry. And he says, yeah, we're thinking about our survival here in this place. And I said, you know, that's really a shame. And he says, well, the companies just want one thing. They want money, and that's the way it is.
Yeah, that's
the
way it
is. And I thought to myself, well, yeah, that what a defeatist attitude. But a lot of people have that here.
Well, you've been spending a lot of time over the last years traveling around the country, talking to all kinds of people, all walks of life. What is the attitude that you hear about unions?
I mean, they're mixed. If the boss is not around, a lot of workers would be receptive to an argument about unions, in principle at least. But when they meet the least resistance from the employer, then they sometimes change their tune because they're afraid. I think one of the things you notice about this country is that sort of fear and sense of inadequacy is kind of pervasive. And the notion that nothing can be done about anything, and this fake kind of populism that the rich get everything they want and the poor get nothing, and something should be done about that, but who knows what.
Well, then people also tend to blame themselves a lot for their
problems. Well, they do absolutely blame themselves a lot. We had a neighbor in a little town that we lived in, and, you know, she'd had a kind of a hard life and was now working a couple of jobs and stuff like that. And if you talk to her, it was like, I made bad decisions. We wouldn't think about it, and wouldn't even think about it in any other way. And that's the kind of lack of a solidaristic society that you have here in the United States that unions themselves have succumbed to. Like, if you go back to the auto workers, for example, I mean, they should have been one of the leaders of the class struggle, so to speak. They should have been one of the leaders of the working class, the fighting edge of the working class, since they had a lot of potential power at one time, and they chose not to do it. I mean, I had auto workers just be yapping and complaining that teachers went on strike. Of course, then you have a lot of workers that would yap and complain about the high pay that the auto workers are making. I tried to tell auto workers one time in a class that the unions ought to at least fight for the kind of social welfare that Scandinavian countries had. And a guy says, well, you should move there if you don't like it here.
Well,
that was an auto worker telling me that. And this was a guy, you know, I used to sometimes be embarrassed about the pay that I made as a college teacher, which where I taught was not that high. But then I started to realize in a lot of the union classes I was teaching, I was the lowest paid person in the class.
Well, yeah, now they'd be lucky to have a job, though.
No, right, I agree. So, you know, now it's a different matter. And union guys telling me, you're opening a lot of eyes, and I would be thinking, well, the union should have opened your eyes. You know, what's going on here? No, but I think, you know, the polls tell you, and my experience is that a lot of people are sympathetic to what unions do, but not sympathetic enough to take action. Now, they can be motivated, and there's a lot of examples of that, mainly, ironically, I suppose, among immigrant workers who have it the worst and seem to be willing to take the most risks and stand out and protest and organize. You know, have these worker centers, you have those, I talk about the workers down in Immokalee in Florida that boycotted Taco Bell and McDonald's and, you know, want some significant benefits. And, you know, these are people a lot of times not even documented workers. And, you know, they take those kinds of actions, travel all around the country, agitate, organize, educate, and so on. And it'd be nice if other unions would do the same things.
Well,
you don't even want to get me started on
some of them. A lot of the immigrants have not yet been assimilated into the American way of consciousness. So.
Well, I always say that, you know, you hear a lot of progressives say, well, we rely on the immigrants. And I always think to myself, you better work fast. Because the American society is such that the second generation and the third generation of immigrants, they will take on the values of the dominant society, believe me. I noticed that already. You know, you go around to motels, and a lot of motels are run by people from India. And when we first started traveling around the country, they were pretty nice people. But then you travel around the country 10 years later, and you got a second generation in there, and they've sort of caught on to this, you know, the way the society works. It's a little bit different matter then. And not that they're not nice, but they're a little bit harder, a little bit colder, a little bit more money-oriented than maybe the first generation that came over was. And so, you know, you have to, better work fast, put it that way.
Well, we've only got a few minutes left, so let's have a service-oriented closing to this this segment. If people are listening and they think that maybe they want to try to organize a union at their workplace, how would they go about that?
How would they go about organizing a union? Well, the first thing the first thing you got to do is probably you got to contact the union, and you better make that a careful contact. In other words, you better look into things first, and you want to try to see how much support there is inside your workplace before you do that. And you need to talk to as many people as you can, and you need to note their sympathies, and you need to think, well, is this a viable kind of thing? And then you need to contact a decent union, and you need to talk to that union and see what kind of strategy you're going to work out. A lot of unions, you know, the best kind of strategy is an inside strategy where you build up the union slowly and you try to build up the capacities of the rank and file. So if your workplace is divided into sections, then you need representatives in each section of that workplace. You need to form a committee, and then you need to work out a plan in terms of how you're going to get the rest of the workforce supportive of you. Some unions do it with petitions, you know, where workers are urged to sign petitions, or workers are you demand that workers do certain things of outreach, and you build up support for the union slowly until you're ready to take the company on. It's really a difficult thing these days because the law, et cetera, is stacked against the workers, and so it's pretty, you know, once the company gets wind of that, retribution can fly pretty fast, and so you have to prepare the workers for that. A lot of unions aren't willing to do that. They're not willing to devote the time and money and effort to do that. And I'm sure you know one of the unions I might be thinking about when I say that, our largest union. Now, sometimes it does that, you know, the Service Employees International Union. Sometimes it does that. But a lot of times it doesn't do that. A lot of times workers are organized sort of from the top down because it's a top-down kind of union. And then the end result is probably not a good one. Because then the workers don't, you know, the workers don't know quite what they've done or what they've gotten into. They're not empowered by the act of, organizing. Now, even if you do that, you know, even if you take a long time, even if you build up an inside committee, even if you start the negotiations, so to speak, before you've got a union, where you get workers willing to do certain things, like wear certain shirts to work or wear insignia to work or to demand meetings with the supervisor, so you start to try to empower the workers at the beginning. You still might lose. You have a better chance of winning when you do those kinds of things. You have a better chance of winning when you think of the union as your own as opposed to an insurance company that you pay a dues to. You're much more likely to win campaigns like that. I mean, statistical studies by people like Kate Bronfenbrenner have shown that to be the case. But the first thing is probably you got to contact that union, and you got to be careful about that contact because you got to look into what's the record of the union. You want to try to talk to people in it, try to talk to members of it, find workplaces that they do represent and see what kind of a union it is. You know, there's good union locals in just about every union, no matter what. I mean, there's probably even good locals inside unions like the International Longshore Association. I mean, look what the Charleston Five did.
This being America, in other words, you got to shop around. Huh?
No, you really do, because that's a big decision. If you make that first bad decision and you get a union that's not very good, well then, you know, you're in a lot of trouble. I think that's sort of the way I would approach it. That's always the way I would approach it when we tried to organize workers wherever I worked or whenever I was involved in organizations of other workers. It's a ground up process. It has to empower the rank and file as you go along, because otherwise, how are you going to win? And if you do win, how are you going to get an agreement? You need all kinds of tactics. And the more of the rank and file workers you have involved, the more brains you have. People can be quite ingenious if you give them a chance to be. If you give them some good leadership, not top-down leadership, not where you talk for them. Like I was with the California Nurses Association in San Antonio, and there you could see that the union had done that. You had all of these nurses that knew a lot of things, asked a lot of sharp questions, had good organization. They'll probably win. They'll have a good chance to win. On the other hand, where only the union spokespersons would speak at a meeting like that and the rank and file keep their mouth shut, well, then you know probably you got a little bit of trouble.
All right, we're just about out of time, but you do write a blog, Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate. Tell people what that's all about and how they can track it down.
Well, it's cheapmotelsandahotplate.org, all one word for the Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate. And I have some things that are like more light travel-oriented things. Where, you know, I try to make them always have something to say. It's interesting, we talked about the auto workers, so I decided to write up a little entry that I'm going to try to post today or tomorrow about some of the things we've been talking about here today. And that's how you can access, and I'm I got my email address and everything on there. People can write comments, and I try to respond if somebody asks questions and what have you. So that's one way you can get in touch with me if you need to.
And that that blog is named after a book you did a couple of years ago.
Yeah, the book I wrote was called Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate, an Economist Travelogue. And that was a book about us traveling around the country for 7 years, living in all different kinds of places. And it was my take on the country. I tried to make it a travelogue that would give you some practical advice about traveling and appreciate the beauty of this country, which is quite considerable. But at the same time, look at the places in which you lived in terms of what kind of work people do, the gap between the rich and the poor, what the environment looked like. Actually, when you think about it now, it's sort of a take on the country right before everything went to hell in a handbasket.
Well, it sure is doing that, but we have President Hope and Change who's going to turn everything around, right?
Well, let's hope so. It hasn't been completely labor-unfriendly, I'll put it to you that way.
Well, these days that passes for good news.
I know, but that's not enough. That's why demands have to be made. I mean, I'm just reading how much money the SEIU donated to the Democratic Party in the last election, and the UAW has donated, and how the president of the Steelworkers Union said in an interview I saw written up, I think it was in the New York Times, the American workers don't need to take to the streets because the union has lobbyists in Washington.
That's
I
mean, beautiful.
Can you imagine the president of a union saying that? This is the workers that were shot in the, you know, whose members were shot in the back in the Memorial Day massacre in Chicago in 1937 or 1938.
Well,
and he's saying that's all they need is a few lobbyists in Washington? I don't think so. That's not going to do the trick.
We're out of time, I'm sorry to say. And with that in mind, happy May Day. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I've been speaking with Michael Yates, author of Why Unions Matter, just out in its second edition for Monthly Review Press. And check out cheapmotelsandahotplace.org also while you're at it. Very fine book, very useful book. Let's go out with this bit of music just out from Fisher Spooner. Money can't dance, and it can't, you know. Bye.